questions just about issues going on right now, but I think for our readers, especially back in Britain, they're just very interested in your perspective on the future of your party. And, you know, many of our readers kind of think of the Republican Party as a party of government, as, you know, the party of Reagan and of George Bush Sr., and just have a lot of questions about where it is now and where it's going and that sort of thing. So I wanted to start by just asking you about the fiscal cliff, whether you feel there will be a deal, what kind of shape that deal would take.
There will be a deal because the American people won't accept the alternative. And you've got to remember that all these members of Congress must return to their respective districts and hold town hall meetings, and they're going to have to explain the one issue that all Americans can kind of get their heads around, and that is a downgrade in our credit by Moody's, much like Standard & Poor's did a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. That's an event that seems to capture the imagination of every American citizen. How dare you downgrade the credit of the United States economy? Since it's never been done in the history of our nation. I mean, that's a pretty significant threshold to be crossing. Mm-hmm. And I remember well what had happened a year ago when I was on the campaign trail. That was the one issue in town hall meeting after town hall meeting that seemed to really put in proper perspective the nature of our challenges going mm-hmm. forward. So my sense is there will be some deal, maybe not in finished form by the end of the year, but certainly the contours that would take us first quarter into a deal. There will have to be wins on both sides. That's just the way deals are done.
Yeah.
There will have to be some win on the revenue side for Democrats, but Republicans have to be careful in ensuring that they walk away with a win that will then translate into further defining the new Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an example of that would be tax reform.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to get some win on tax reform. Why? Because one, it's an historic opportunity to shore up our competitiveness. It would be a shame if we went through this exercise and didn't focus at all on the rest of the 21st century and what we need to do to prepare for that reality. So tax reform on the growth side is going to be a critical win.
And what specifically are you talking
specifics
about tax reform?
Would be to take a stab at the $1,100,000,000,000 in loopholes.
Right.
You've got them on the corporate side, you've got them on the individual side. You can phase them out, as I did as governor of Utah when I delivered a flat tax. You can come up with any kind of a mathematical equation in terms of how aggressively, at what levels you want to phase them out, but mm-hmm. the process must begin.
Mm-hmm.
And that would allow us to broaden the base fundamentally and lower rates where we can. But this will leave us with a cleaner code on the individual side, on the corporate side, which is stiflingly high right now when you look at the international comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to have a finished deal on that by the end of the year. But for the sake of our nation's competitiveness and the Republicans defining what they want to achieve longer term, we've got to get back to the party that's known as the one that really does believe in economic competitiveness
mm-hmm.
and the steps now that we need to take to prepare for that journey. So we've been known for we can get into this conversation later, but you know, we've been known for too long as a party of that's known by what we're against as opposed to what we're for. The party of fear and not of opportunity for everybody.
Mm.
So that's got to be one win that Republicans can stand up. These deals are only done if both sides can stand up and say, we got something out of it, and it's very important to us. And the second part would be somehow dealing with the entitlement side, pensions, and looking at the sustainability of pensions
mm-hmm.
Going forward, which would mean, you know, maybe reindexing to the consumer price index on things like Social Security. Moving out the eligibility age would be obviously something worth beginning.
Yeah.
Those kinds of moves would at least begin a process whereby we can begin a journey of reform around the entitlement programs mm-hmm. because they're just simply unsustainable mm-hmm. at this point.
In terms of wins that the Democrats can take to the bank, do you think Republicans should be open to higher tax rates on high earners?
Well, our going-in position ought to be Simpson-Bowles. And I think that's what, ultimately, when we look at the finished product, I suspect that's what we're going to be looking at.
Yeah.
Weeks from now, months from now, like the election, $2 billion spent, and pretty much a status quo outcome, we may look at the finished package and say, we knew it all along.
Yeah.
You know, why didn't one of the candidates own Simpson Bowles and drive it all the way home? It would have saved us a lot of anguish.
Yeah.
And there's no position like the presidency. You know, the bully pulpit of the presidency. Teddy Roosevelt told us all about that when he was president 100 years ago. Use that bully pulpit to drive home, you know, a winning package.
Do you sense the president is open to those kind of compromises that you're talking about in terms of real reform of the tax code and taking a serious look at entitlements?
He's under enormous pressure, I know, by the business community, where he has had many meetings since his election. You've noticed they've come and gone.
In and out of the White House, yeah.
And my guess is that he's hearing a great deal. You know, I serve on a couple of big corporate boards, you know, Ford Motor Company and Caterpillar. I know a lot of the CEOs, and I know what they feel needs to be done in terms of restoring our competitiveness. And some good things are happening right now. It's a function of building on a trend that is moving in our direction in terms of rebuilding our manufacturing muscle, insourcing of jobs from overseas, finding that because the rest of the world is pretty much uncompetitive economically, we have enormous opportunity in the years ahead to be able to rebuild our manufacturing base.
Right.
So these are all the messages that clearly the White House is hearing. And that really gets right to the heart and soul of tax reform and our spending. What percentage of our GDP do we want to spend longer term, and what impact does that have on competitiveness?
Yeah.
So he's going to have to think in terms of a longer term deal, but also his legacy. You know, what is the one issue that he'll be remembered by?
Mm.
Picking up an economy that was in the hole, dealing with a couple of wars abroad, and then how that all ends will be how he's remembered, among other things.
Mm.
And that will be measured economically by jobs,
mm-hmm.
pretty much, by our unemployment rate. And all of this, you know, is part of getting to that end point.
Right. So there should be a moment of opportunity and a moment to seize long-term trends rather than fix an immediate problem.
this is the one issue that should not be lost in this conversation,
yeah.
is, you know, a lot like 1986, you know, we went through tax reform. Yeah, the magic there was you had Reagan pushing it on the executive branch side. He had a guy named Jack Kemp on the congressional side who, you know, was able to shepherd things with great alacrity on Capitol Hill, and you had this winning team. But it was with a view to the future.
Right.
We've got to have a view to the future. Any kind of short-term gain would be just that. It would be narcotic-like, and it would wear off pretty quickly.
Right. Speaking about the future and about the Hill, you speak to a lot of Republicans here in D.C., especially younger ones, who want to go back to being, you know, a party of government, a party that's, you know, not constantly sort of wrestling with its farthest fringe, but is sort of moving forward. And a lot of them are despondent right now, just about where the party is, but also the trajectory it seems to be on. And I wonder, do you think they should be more optimistic? And if so, what can you point to as a sign of optimism?
Well, it's really tough to define Republicanism today,
mm-hmm.
because we don't have a leader and we don't have a platform. We have a platform that came out of the last convention,
yeah.
but that isn't the platform that's going to take us to victory going forward, in the sense that we need to be a party that speaks to shoring up our fundamentals around economic competitiveness and freedom and liberty for everybody. You know, we can't be known as a party that is fear-based, that doesn't believe in math, in the sense that to win, you've got to be the party of addition, not subtraction and division. So A, you've got to have numbers in your favor. You've got to have at least enough people following you who allow you to win the election. And we don't have that today. And B, you have to have a message that speaks to the reality of our times.
Mm-hmm.
And to my mind, that basically comes down to balancing budgets and getting out of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Balancing budgets, I say sort of metaphorically, for we've got some important steps to take that begin moving us toward greater 21st century competitiveness. That will be the transcendent issue of our time. So many other issues, you know, ought to be worked out by the states. We ought to be the party of the 10th Amendment and federalism, letting states take the lead on certain issues. But one overall that really speaks to opportunity and upward mobility for all of our people. If you can't get a break educationally or job-wise, you don't stand a chance. And we're not speaking enough to all of the people in America by way of real hope and opportunity. And our policies have to be focused around that reality.
So you've outlined the problem and you've outlined where you think the solution lies, but are you optimistic that the party can get there, can bridge the gap between the two?
Well, these things go in cycles, as Theodore White used to write about. I remember the Democrats post 80 and 84, they wandered. And it wasn't until 92 that they were able to capture a message that allowed them to do those two things, to expand the math, the demographics, and B, to have a transcendent message that people could actually relate to. And that carried them some distance.
Yeah.
It's still carrying them, I would argue. So we've got to make sure that we do those things as well, that we capture lost demographics, that's the math, and B, that we have an overarching transcendent message that speaks to opening new opportunities for all of our citizens. And that's traditionally been our party. We're the party of liberty, the party of freedom, the party of opportunity, the party of government getting out of people's way, giving states the right to move out under, you know, their own, you know, constitutional authority. And
are you relaxed about things like gay marriage in states, if that's what the state wants to do?
Absolutely. If states move in that direction, then that should be their prerogative.
And we shouldn't
quibble with that. That's the way our system was set up.
I
think it functions best that way. Having been a governor, all you want is the autonomy to do what is right for your people. So that's the troubling part, is that we don't have a leader. We don't have a defined agenda. But the good news is that will come in time. You've got to go through this reformation process. All voices have to be heard. We've got to get some new leaders who kind of pop up. They've got to become viable. And let's face it, Republicans won't be successful until we win a major election. And then you're off to the races. You've got a winning...
Nothing succeeds like success.
That's right, like success. So you've got a candidate who becomes president. You therefore have a platform that person ran on. And you've captured the, you know, you control the body politic from there on. So we're a bit in a hole, but I also think this is a very important time for the party, in the sense that it's a rebuilding effort. And the one thing that will be as sure as the sunrise tomorrow is the Democrats will become lazy and they will take their eye off the ball, and we'll see more crony capitalism in Washington, because the state will grow, and as the state grows, so do all the ancillary and subsidiary functions of lobbyists and K Street advisors. And that's the stuff that Americans hate. And more than, or as much, I should say, as the economic side, where we're preparing for the 21st century, we have to be the party of reform. We need a little more Theodore Roosevelt in us, and that is to return the system to the people, a system that today lacks trust, that is full of crony capitalism, and that finds too much rent seeking on the part of the special interest groups. So we should be talking about issues like redistricting reform. That's where a lot of the deep partisanship begins. We ought to be talking about how we finance our campaigns. We ought to be talking about term limits. We ought to be talking about the revolving door, allowing members of Congress to file right on out, you know, to become a lobbyist, to, you know, find a job with the groups they just regulated the year before.
And those issues, while obviously important, do they win votes? Is it the kind of thing people are, you know, talking about around their kitchen table?
I don't think there's any question. When it's explained to them, yes. Because there's a fiscal deficit and there's a trust deficit. And I've long been a believer in the idea that we've got to tackle both with equal measures of of aggressiveness. Mm-hmm. The trust deficit, everybody knows it's there, but they don't know where to begin.
Right.
I mean, it's a tall order. But to have a younger generation begin coming up saying, we've had enough of the status quo, divided government, nothing gets done, haven't even seen a budget in 3 years, to say, well, how do we begin fixing the situation? Yeah. It's a long-term play to be sure, but the very fact that a party would be able to begin a process,
yeah.
and particularly capturing the younger generation that knows that they've got to have a better system than yeah. the one we're handing down, that's where you begin bringing in the numbers. And state by state, looking at initiatives like redistricting, like how we reform the way in which we finance campaigns. Everybody knows it's broken, but nobody wants to talk about it because they benefit too much from a broken system.
You mentioned new leaders within the Republican Party a few minutes ago, and I just wondered whether you were encouraged by the names that crop up in terms of not just 2016, but it's just in. You know, the future lights of the party. I'm thinking of the Rubios and the Ryans of the Christies. Whether those are names that you could see leading the party in the direction you want, or whether there's still.
Yeah, I think they're all good, and they all deserve high marks for what they have done individually to get to where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Our conversation will need to be expanded and broadened substantially.
Yeah,
there are a lot of voices out there that were Reagan Republicans and now don't know what they are. I've had a lot of people filter through this home, and they say, I was a Reagan Republican. I don't know what I am today, but I want to find my roots again.
Right.
You got a lot of people wandering here. And then the young vote is totally up for grabs. They're all unaffiliated for the most part. They don't do the young Republican, young Democrat thing like they did when I was in school.
Mm.
They're unaffiliated, and they follow a leader. And they follow a leader who seems to embody their aspirations. And I guess on the part of the other area that gives me some bit of optimism is the Democrats this go around didn't necessarily define a bright, shining future.
Yeah.
They were just a little more acceptable than the Republicans.
Right.
So it's not like we're up against a major visionary new frontier move that has brought in the next generation and they're there to stay. I just don't believe that to be the case. I think it's.
And you don't feel demographically that the Democrats have assembled this progressive coalition that kind of represents the demographic future of the country is still...
There's enough in the way of the unaffiliated voters out there who increasingly go toward the candidate based on ideas that I think the Republican Party can remain competitive with the right secret sauce,
right.
the right formula.
Right.
We just haven't defined that.
Yeah.
But it must be tied to our roots, who we are. The talk of the country in terms of cinema is Lincoln. Lincoln was our first Republican, and nobody reflects on his style of leadership and his talk of individual dignity and unity that brought this nation together. And go read his second inaugural address, at the Lincoln Memorial, where he ends his speech talking about widows and orphans, and we've got to take care of them. We don't talk like that anymore.
Yeah.
And we don't talk like Theodore Roosevelt or Eisenhower or even Reagan.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we can learn a lot by reflecting on our past.
And just to press you, I mean, specifically, are there any leaders within the Republican Party who really impress you, or are you still waiting for someone to better capture?
We're going through a generation of realignment, and so it's really hard to say where the party will be in terms of leaders.
Yeah.
It's unfair to pick a winner at this point,
right.
because it ought to be a very competitive process in terms of ideas and how people respond to some of those ideas. I think it's wide open, and I think it's an exciting time for Republicans in the sense that anytime you remake an enterprise, it's more exciting than just managing an enterprise. And that's the way we have to see it.
Yeah.
Another, I think... element of concern, if I could go back to that, is the economy is going to improve. I've no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And we're going to win back some of our manufacturing base. Unemployment's going to go down. Growth is going to go up, maybe even more so than we're forecasting today. I think the trends will be very strongly in that direction, which means for the next couple of election cycles, the Democrats, for the first time in my lifetime, might own the economy.
Mm.
Which ought to be a very troubling thing for Republicans, because that's always been our bread and butter.
Yeah.
Economy, jobs, strong and confident foreign policy and defense, and a strong dose of, you know, libertarianism. But if we stand, you know, on the doorstep of an election in 2016 with, you know, unemployment down and job prospects rising, and our GDP performance somewhat recovered, mm-hmm. more than 3%, you know, that's going to be a tough narrative to run against. And so not only will you have the forward momentum of the Democrats coming out of the very deep hole we were in, but you could very well have, you know, the American people who will at that point view the Democratic Party as the party best suited to handle the economy.
Yeah.
And that takes away from the Republicans one of our strongest flanks historically.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were transitioning from public life into private life. Is that a definite? Could you imagine any situation in which you were to run again for president, or?
My life is full of serendipity and unexpected departures. Right now, this is where we want to be. And if you get back into private or public life, you know, you have to ask some fundamental questions, like, are you electable?
Mm.
Just like the party itself,
yeah.
You know, is it electable?
Yeah.
You know, are you as a candidate electable?
Yeah.
You know, B, is what you're good at and bring to the table relevant in today's America? You don't know until you get there. And C, I guess, is kind of, you know, is your family prepared to take the ride with you?
Yeah.
Because politics does one of two things. It either destroys a family or it brings them closer together. Gladly, our three elections have brought us much closer together, and for that I'm grateful.
Mm.
But that also assumes you've got everybody on board willing to do something like that.
Yeah.
Not for the faint-hearted.
Yeah. And that question of are you electable, I assume you've been reflecting on that since the primary election. Do you have any conclusions about are you electable within a Republican primary, and are you electable in a broader context?
Well, having run twice for governor,
yeah.
you know, in our re-election, we got 70% of the vote. I got more Democrats than my Democratic opponent.
Yeah.
We got all the Republicans. Because, you know, not that I'm a good politician, I'm not. It's just we did what we thought was right for all the people.
Yeah.
And we didn't play games, and we didn't play partisan politics. We put the best people we could find, whether they supported me or not, in positions of leadership.
Yeah.
Managed the state, got them going. You know, we were awarded best managed state in America, best economy in America, a lot of good kudos. But to me, that really was a reminder that politics works best when you leave partisanship at the door, mm-hmm. and you pull together during times of need, like we have right now, where unity really does matter. In a primary, if you're not willing to pander,
yeah.
Or sign pledges, which I wasn't willing to do, it could be a tough ride.
But you must have thought that there was an opening at some point for a candidate like you who was going to be, you know, promising more moderate but more pragmatic positions. Was that sort of assumption just not right to begin with, or was it?
It was fair to launch an effort,
yeah.
which we did, only to find that the fact that I'd worked for a Democrat. In the old world, that would have been seen as putting country first.
Yeah.
In today's world, sometimes that's seen as crossing a boundary that you shouldn't cross.
Yeah.
I do it again. That's just who I am. So if that's unacceptable, then I guess I am too.
Yeah.
And the prospect of putting all your chips down in New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
I thought was a viable strategy.
Yeah.
If we had had another week or two. See how we say.
Yeah.
I have no doubt we could have taken second. We could have overtaken Ron Paul. And we are moving very, very quick. We took third.
Yeah.
That, to me, third wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
You know, the marketplace sets expectations
if
you were a stock trading on the big board. And we got third instead of second. Now, had we placed second, we would have left with a head of steam. You know how the expectation games go. Into South Carolina, it would have been different.
Mm-hmm.
But we took third, and that was just below the threshold that I thought made us viable. And that has an impact on fundraising, on the buzz factor, and everything else. So a second place out of New Hampshire would have changed things quite considerably.
Yeah. So it sounds like you do think your conclusion hasn't been that there's no place for somebody like me to run in a Republican primary and win. It was that this year and possibly bits of your own biography were the problem.
If people kind of disaggregated my political career, they'd find that I have a conservative record.
Yeah.
And that's the way I view things. I'm very conservative on fiscal issues. I like balanced budgets. I like preparing for, you know, competitiveness, whether you're a state or whether you're a nation. That's the future.
Yeah.
And the sooner we get there and prepare ourselves, the better off all of our people are going to be. But on the social side, you know, I got dinged a bit, which is fine.
Yeah.
I was, I think, one of the first governors to enact the DREAM Act and came out, so to speak, for gay rights in a state that was 70% or 80% against me on that.
Yeah.
I thought if Lincoln were here, he'd be saying equality under the laws is an American value.
Yeah.
So now you may have some people circle back and want to kind of refresh the party on some of these issues. And I think, you know, we've been talking about this for quite some time, and I did as governor, I did on the campaign trail. So, you know, you can take what I am, which has got to be, you know, focused on balanced budgets and competitiveness. And then on the other side, you know, you have to be seen as a reformer,
yeah,
which I was as governor and which I advocated on the stump. If that formula isn't enough, then you don't have an opening.
Yeah.
But we're not spending full time looking at some opening that we can fit in.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of plays out organically. And if it does, people feel that you're possibly competitive in a new sort of freshened up Republican Party, then maybe it's worth thinking about. But as of right now, we've got other things going on.
Gotcha. Do you feel like there are structural changes that could be made to the Republican primary contest that would help lead to, I don't know, less skewed results? And
well, here's what happens. You have the AIM straw poll,
yeah,
and whoever wins that, and you win it by, you know, pumping $1 million into a party, basically,
yeah,
bussing people in and giving them a good dinner and putting Randy Travis on the stage, then asking for people's vote.
Yeah.
Of course you're going to vote for it. And so you come out of there with that esteem, as Bachman did.
Yeah.
You get on the cover of Newsweek, and the money comes in, you get the buzz, and then you go to the CPAC straw poll in,
yeah,
Florida. And you do the same thing. So Bachman took first in Iowa and last in Florida because she focused on one, and Herman Cain focused on the other, put a bunch of money into that. And so you get, you know, little blips of momentum and buzz that seem to sustain your effort early on. And you look back and it's all fairly artificial and,
mm-hmm,
ephemeral and really doesn't speak to, you know, long-term competitive candidates that can actually go the distance on the big issues of the day.
Yeah.
So we didn't get the buzz, obviously, going out of those early straw polls and CPAC events for reasons that, you know, are arguable.
Yeah.
You know, you work for the guy that, you know, you're trying to beat.
Yeah.
That's not good. You're in favor of science and you want to defer to the scientific community on climate change. That's not good.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a little too progressive on gay rights. And you're dismissed before,
yeah,
they kind of drill down and say, well, he balanced budgets, he delivered a flat tax, he's pro-life, he's pro-Second Amendment, and all this other stuff. So you get caught up in a lot of the issues over which you're easily dismissed without people,
yeah,
giving you proper consideration.
I was going back and I was reading some of the clippings from, I guess, late 2011 and early 2012, and one of the phrases that stuck out is that Huntsman's words are conservative, but the music is liberal. I don't know if you remember that, but, you know, there really is a lot in your record that if a conservative, if they want to see it, you know, can be very encouraged by, but that there were times when it seemed like, even though you had all of that in the bank, you almost, I think some of the base almost felt you were kind of trying to be antagonistic by talking about, you know, the importance of science and climate change and the importance of, you know, not bashing gay rights on the stump and stuff. And I just wonder.
Well, heaven forbid somebody be honest.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I didn't talk like a radio talk show host when you're supposed to show anger.
Yeah.
I don't do that.
Yeah.
Because I don't believe the American people are angry.